Chapter 10. Sleep proved to be indeed the problem. For what seemed a great time, cramped and wearied and soon hungry and thirsty as well, he sat still in the darkness, trying not to attend to the unflagging repetition of "Ransom, ransom, ransom." But presently he found himself listening to a conversation of which he knew he had not heard the beginning, and realized that he had slept. The lady seemed to be saying very little. Weston's voice was speaking gently and continuously. It was not talking about the fixed land, nor even about Maleldil. It appeared to be telling, with extreme beauty and pathos, a number of stories, and at first Ransom could not perceive any connecting link between them. They were all about women, but women who had apparently lived at different periods of the world's history, and in quite different circumstances. From the lady's replies, it appeared that the stories contained much that she did not understand. But oddly enough, the unman did not mind. If the questions aroused by any one story proved at all difficult to answer, the speaker simply dropped that story and instantly began another. The heroines of the story seemed all to have suffered a great deal. They had been oppressed by fathers, cast off by husbands, deserted by lovers. Their children had risen up against them, and society had driven them out. But the stories all ended, in a sense, happily, sometimes with honours and praises to a heroine still living, more often with tardy acknowledgement and unavailing tears after her death. As the endless speech proceeded, the lady's questions grew always fewer. Some meaning for the words death and sorrow, though what kind of meaning Ransom could not even guess, was apparently being created in her mind by mere repetition. At last it dawned upon him what all these stories were about. Each one of these women had stood forth alone and braved a terrible risk for her child, her lover, or her people. Each had been misunderstood, reviled, and persecuted, but each also magnificently vindicated by the event. The precise details were often not very easy to follow. Ransom had more than a suspicion that many of these noble pioneers had been what, in ordinary terrestrial speech, we call witches or perverts. But that was all in the background. What emerged from the stories was rather an image than an idea. The picture of the tall, slender form, unbowed, though the world's weight rested upon its shoulders, stepping forth fearless and friendless into the dark to do for others what those others forbade it to do, yet needed to have done. And all the time, as a sort of background to these goddess shapes, the speaker was building up a picture of the other sex. No word was directly spoken on the subject, but one felt them there as a huge, dim multitude of creatures, pitifully childish and complacently arrogant. Timid, meticulous, unoriginating, sluggish and ox-like, rooted to the earth almost in their indolence, prepared to try nothing, to risk nothing, to make no exertion, and capable of being raised into full life only by the unthanked and rebellious virtue of their females. It was very well done. Ransom, who had little of the pride of sex, found himself for a few moments all but believing it. In the midst of this, the darkness was suddenly torn by a flash of lightning. A few seconds later came a revel of Perelandrian thunder, like the playing of a heavenly tambourine, and after that, warm rain. Ransom did not much regard it. The flash had shown him the unman sitting bolt upright, the lady raised on one elbow, the dragon lying awake at her head, a grove of trees beyond, and great waves against the horizon. He was thinking of what he had seen. He was wondering how the lady could see that face, those jaws monotonously moving as if they were rather munching than talking, and not know the creature to be evil. He saw, of course, that this was unreasonable of him. He himself was doubtless an uncouth figure in her eyes. She could have no knowledge either about evil or about the normal appearance of terrestrial man to guide her. The expression on her face, revealed in the sudden light, was one that he had not seen there before. Her eyes were not fixed on the narrator. As far as that went, her thoughts might have been 1,000 miles away. Her lips were shut and a little pursed. Her eyebrows were slightly raised. He had not yet seen her look so like a woman of our own race, and yet her expression was one he had not very often met on Earth, except, as he realized with a shock, on the stage. Like a tragedy queen was the disgusting comparison that arose in his mind. Of course, it was a gross exaggeration. It was an insult for which he could not forgive himself. And yet, the tableau revealed by the lightning had photographed itself on his brain. Do what he would, he found it impossible not to think of that new look in her face. A very good tragedy queen, no doubt. The heroine of a very great tragedy, very nobly played by an actress who was a good woman in real life. By earthly standards, an expression to be praised, even to be revered. But remembering all that he had read in her countenance before, the unself-conscious radiance, the frolic sanctity, the depth of stillness that reminded him sometimes of infancy and sometimes of extreme old age, while the hard youth and valiancy of face and body denied both, he found this new expression horrifying. The fatal touch of invited grandeur, of enjoyed pathos, the assumption, however slight, of a role, seemed a hateful vulgarity. Perhaps she was doing no more, he had good hope that she was doing no more, than responding in a purely imaginative fashion to this new art of story or poetry. But by God, she'd better not. And for the first time the thought, "This can't go on," formulated itself in his mind. "I will go where the leaves cover us from the rain," said her voice in the darkness. Ransom had hardly noticed that he was getting wet. In a world without clothes, it is less important. But he rose when he heard her move and followed her as well as he could by ear. The unmanned seemed to be doing the same. They progressed in total darkness on a surface as variable as that of water. Every now and then there was another flash. One saw the lady walking erect, the unmanned slouching by her side, with Weston's shirt and shorts now sodden and clinging to it, and the dragon puffing and waddling behind. At last they came to a place where the carpet under their feet was dry, and there was a drumming noise of rain on firm leaves above their heads. They lay down again. "And another time," began the unmanned at once, "there was a queen in our world who ruled over a little land."
"Hush," said the lady. "Let us listen to the rain."
Then, after a moment, she added,
"What was that?"
"It was some beast I never heard before."
And indeed, there had been something very like a low growl close beside them. "I do not know," said the voice of Weston.
"I think I do," said Ransom.
"Hush,"
said the lady again, and no more was said that night. This was the beginning of a series of days and nights which Ransom remembered with loathing for the rest of his life. He had been only too correct in supposing that his enemy required no sleep. Fortunately, the lady did, but she needed a good deal less than Ransom, and possibly, as the days passed, came to take less than she needed. It seemed to Ransom that whenever he dozed, he awoke to find the unmanned already in conversation with her. He was dead tired. He could hardly have endured it at all, but for the fact that their hostess quite frequently dismissed them both from her presence. On such occasions, Ransom kept close to the unmanned. It was a rest from the main battle, but it was a very imperfect rest. He did not dare to let the enemy out of his sight for a moment, and every day its society became more unendurable. He had full opportunity to learn the falsity of the maxim that the Prince of Darkness is a gentleman. Again and again he felt that a suave and subtle Mephistopheles with red cloak and rapier and a feather in his cap, or even a sombre, tragic Satan out of Paradise Lost, would have been a welcome release from the thing he was actually doomed to watch. It was not like dealing with a wicked politician at all. It was much more like being set to guard an imbecile or a monkey or a very nasty child. What had staggered and disgusted him when it first began saying, "Ransom, Ransom," continued to disgust him every day and every hour. It showed plenty of subtlety and intelligence when talking to the lady, but Ransom soon perceived that it regarded intelligence simply and solely as a weapon, which it had no more wish to employ in its off-duty hours than a soldier has to do bayonet practice when he is on leave. Thought was for it a device necessary to certain ends, but thought in itself did not interest it. It assumed reason as externally and inorganically as it had assumed Weston's body. The moment the lady was out of sight, it seemed to relapse. A great deal of his time was spent in protecting the animals from it. Whenever it got out of sight, or even a few yards ahead, it would make a grab at any beast or bird within its reach and pull out some fur or feathers. Ransom tried whenever possible to get between it and its victim. On such occasions there were nasty moments when the two stood facing each other. It never came to a fight, for the unmanned merely grinned and perhaps spat and fell back a little. But before that happened, Ransom usually had opportunity to discover how terribly he feared it. for side by side with his disgust, the more childlike terror of living with a ghost or a mechanized corpse never left him for many minutes together. The fact of being alone with it sometimes rushed upon his mind with such dismay that it took all his reason to resist his longing for society, his impulse to rush madly over the island until he found the lady and to beg her protection. When the unman could not get animals, it was content with plants. It was fond of cutting their outer rinds through with its nails, or grubbing up roots, or pulling off leaves, or even tearing up handfuls of turf. With Ransom himself, it had innumerable games to play. It had a whole repertory of obscenities to perform with its own, or rather with Weston's, body. And the mere silliness of them was almost worse than the dirtiness. It would sit making grimaces at him for hours together, and then, for hours more, it would go back to its old repetition of, "Ransom, Ransom." Often its grimaces achieved a horrible resemblance to people whom Ransom had known and loved in our own world. But worst of all were those moments when it allowed Weston to come back into its countenance. Then its voice, which was always Weston's voice, would begin a pitiful, hesitant mumbling. "You be very careful, Ransom. I'm down in the bottom of a big black hole. No, I'm not, though. I'm on Perelandra. I can't think very well now, but that doesn't matter. He does all my thinking for me. It'll get quite easy presently. That boy keeps on shutting the windows. That's all right. They've taken off my head and put someone else's on me. I'll soon be all right now. They won't let me see my press cuttings." So then I went and told him that if they didn't want me in the first 15, they could jolly well do without me, see? We'll tell that young whelp it's an insult to the examiners to show up this kind of work. What I want to know is why I should pay for a first-class ticket and then be crowded out like this. It's not fair, not fair. I never meant any harm. Could you take some of this weight off my chest? I don't want all those clothes. Let me alone. Let me alone. It's not fair. It's not fair. What enormous blue bottles. They say you get used to them. And then it would end in the canine howl. Ransom never could make up his mind whether it was a trick, or whether a decaying psychic energy that had once been Weston were indeed fitfully and miserably alive within the body that sat there beside him. He discovered that any hatred he had once felt for the professor was dead. He found it natural to pray fervently for his soul. Yet what he felt for Weston was not exactly pity. Up till that moment, whenever he had thought of hell, he had pictured the lost souls as being still human. Now, as the frightful abyss which parts ghosthood from manhood yawned before him, pity was almost swallowed up in horror, in the unconquerable revulsion of the life within him from positive and self-consuming death. If the remains of Weston were, at such moments, speaking through the lips of the unman, then Weston was not now a man at all. The forces which had begun, perhaps years ago, to eat away his humanity, had now completed their work. The intoxicated will which had been slowly poisoning the intelligence and the affections had now at last poisoned itself, and the whole psychic organism had fallen to pieces. Only a ghost was left, an everlasting unrest, a crumbling, a ruin, an odour of decay. And this, thought Ransom, might be my destination, or hers. But of course the hours spent alone with the unman were like hours in a back area. The real business of life was the interminable conversation between the tempter and the green lady. Taken hour by hour, the progress was hard to estimate. But as the days passed, Ransom could not resist the conviction that the general development was in the enemy's favour. There were, of course, ups and downs. Often the unman was unexpectedly repulsed by some simplicity which it seemed not to have anticipated. Often, too, Ransom's own contributions to the terrible debate were, for the moment, successful. There were times when he thought, "Thank God we've won at last." But the enemy was never tired, and Ransom grew more weary all the time, and presently he thought he could see signs that the lady was becoming tired, too. In the end he taxed her with it and begged her to send them both away, but she rebuked him, and her rebuke revealed how dangerous the situation had already become. "Shall I go and rest and play?" she asked, "while all this lies on our hands. Not till I am certain that there is no great deed to be done by me for the king and for the children of our children." It was on those lines that the enemy now worked almost exclusively. Though the lady had no word for duty, he had made it appear to her in the light of a duty that she should continue to fondle the idea of disobedience, and convinced her that it would be a cowardice if she repulsed him. The ideas of the great deed, of the great risk, of a kind of martyrdom were presented to her every day, varied in a thousand forms. The notion of waiting to ask the king before a decision was made had been unobtrusively shuffled aside. Any such cowardice was now not to be thought of. The whole point of her action, the whole grandeur, would lie in taking it without the king's knowledge, in leaving him utterly free to repudiate it, so that all the benefits should be his and all the risks hers. And with the risk, of course, all the magnanimity, the pathos, the tragedy, and the originality. And also, the tempter hinted, it would be no use asking the king, for he would certainly not approve the action. Men were like that. The king must be forced to be free. Now, while she was on her own, now or never, the noble thing must be achieved. And with that now or never, he began to play on a fear which the lady apparently shared with the women of earth, the fear that life might be wasted, some great opportunity let slip. "How if I were as a tree that could have borne gourds, and yet bore none?" she said. Ransom tried to convince her that children were fruit enough. But the young man asked whether this elaborate division of the human race into two sexes could possibly be meant for no other purpose than offspring, a matter which might have been more simply provided for, as it was in many of the plants. A moment later it was explaining that men like Ransom in his own world, men of that intensely male and backward-looking type who always shrank away from the new good, had continuously laboured to keep women down to mere childbearing, and to ignore the high destiny for which Maleldil had actually created her. It told her that such men had already done incalculable harm. Let her look to it that nothing of the sort happened on Perelandra. It was at this stage that it began to teach her many new words, words like creative and intuition and spiritual. But that was one of its false steps. When she had at last been made to understand what creative meant, she forgot all about the great risk and the tragic loneliness, and laughed for a whole minute on end. Finally she told the young man that it was younger even than Piebald, and sent them both away. Ransom gained ground over that, but on the following day he lost it all by losing his temper. The enemy had been pressing on her with more than usual ardour the nobility of self-sacrifice and self-dedication, and the enchantment seemed to be deepening in her mind every moment, when Ransom, goaded beyond all patience, had leaped to his feet and really turned upon her, talking far too quickly and almost shouting, and even forgetting his old solar and intermixing English words. He tried to tell her that he'd seen this kind of unselfishness in action, to tell her of women making themselves sick with hunger rather than begin the meal before the man of the house returned, though they knew perfectly well that there was nothing he disliked more. Of mothers wearing themselves to a ravelling to marry some daughter to a man whom she detested, of Agrippina and of Lady Macbeth. "Can you not see," he shouted, "that he is making you say words that mean nothing? What is the good of saying you would do this for the king's sake when you know it is what the king would hate most? Are you Maleldil that you should determine what is good for the king?" But she understood only a very small part of what he said, and was bewildered by his manner. The young man made capital out of this speech. But through all these ups and downs, all changes of the front line, all counter-attacks and stands and withdrawals, Ransom came to see more and more clearly the strategy of the whole affair. The lady's response to the suggestion of becoming a risk-bearer, a tragic pioneer, was still a response made chiefly out of her love for the king and for her unborn children, and even, in a sense, of Maleldil himself. The idea that he might not really wish to be obeyed to the letter was the sluice through which the whole flood of suggestion had been admitted to her mind. But mixed with this response, from the moment when the unman began its tragic stories, there was the faintest touch of theatricality, the first hint of a self-admiring inclination to seize a grand role in the drama of her world. It was clear that the unman's whole effort was to increase this element. As long as this was but one drop, so to speak, in the sea of her mind, he would not really succeed. Perhaps, while it remained so, she was protected from actual disobedience. Perhaps no rational creature, until such a motive became dominant, could really throw away happiness for anything quite so vague as the tempter's chatter about deeper life and the upward path. The veiled egoism in the conception of noble revolt must be increased. And, Ransom thought, despite many rallies on her part and many setbacks suffered by the enemy, that it was, very slowly and yet perceptibly, increasing. The matter was, of course, cruelly, cruelly complicated. What the young man said was always very nearly true. Certainly it must be part of the divine plan that this happy creature should mature, should become more and more a creature of free choice, should become, in a sense, more distinct from God and from her husband, in order thereby to be at one with them in a richer fashion. In fact, he had seen this very process going on from the moment at which he met her, and had, unconsciously, assisted it. This present temptation, if conquered, would itself be the next and greatest step in the same direction. An obedience freer, more reasoned, more conscious than any she had known before was being put in her power. But for that very reason, the fatal false step which, once taken, would thrust her down into the terrible slavery of appetite and hate and economics and government, which our race knows so well, could be made to sound so like the true one. What made him feel sure that the dangerous element in her interest was growing was her progressive disregard of the plain intellectual bones of the problem. It became harder to recall her mind to the data, a command from Maleldil, a complete uncertainty about the results of breaking it, and a present happiness so great that hardly any change could be for the better. The turgid swell of indistinctly splendid images which the unman aroused, and the transcendent importance of the central image, carried all this away. She was still in her innocence. No evil intention had been formed in her mind. But if her will was uncorrupted, half her imagination was already filled with bright, poisonous shapes. "This can't go on," thought Ransom for the second time. But all his arguments proved in the long run unavailing, and it did go on. There came a night when he was so tired that towards morning he fell into a leaden sleep and slept far into the following day. He woke to find himself alone. A great horror came over him. "What could I have done? What could I have done?" he cried out, for he thought that all was lost. With sick heart and sore head he staggered to the edge of the island. His idea was to find a fish and to pursue the truants to the fixed land, where he felt little doubt that they had gone. In the bitterness and confusion of his mind, he forgot that he had no notion in which direction that land now lay, nor how far it was distant. Hurrying through the woods, he emerged into an open place and suddenly found that he was not alone. Two human figures, robed to their feet, stood before him, silent under the yellow sky. Their clothes were of purple and blue, their heads wore chaplets of silver leaves, and their feet were bare. They seemed to him to be, the one the ugliest, and the other the most beautiful, of the children of men. Then one of them spoke, and he realized that they were none other than the Green Lady herself and the haunted body of Weston. The robes were of feathers, and he knew well the Perelandrian birds from which they had been derived. The art of the weaving, if weaving it could be called, was beyond his comprehension.
"Welcome, Piebald," said the lady. "You have slept long. What do you think of us in our leaves?"
"The birds," said Ransom, "the poor birds. What has he done to them?"
"He has found the feathers somewhere," said the lady carelessly. "They drop them."
"Why have you done this, lady?"
"He has been making me older again. Why did you never tell me, Piebald?"
"Tell you what?"
"We never knew. This one showed me that the trees have leaves and the beasts have fur, and said that in your world the men and women also hung beautiful things about them. Why do you not tell us how we look?" "Oh, Piebald, Piebald, I hope this is not going to be another of the new goods from which you draw back your hand. It cannot be new to you if they all do it in your world."
"Ah," said Ransom, "but it is different there. It is cold."
"Or so the stranger said," she answered. "But not in all parts of your world. He says they do it even where it is warm."
"Has he said why they do it?"
"To be beautiful. Why else?"
said the lady with some wonder in her face. "Thank heaven," thought Ransom, "he is only teaching her vanity, for he had feared something worse. Yet could it be possible in the long run to wear clothes without learning modesty, and through modesty lasciviousness?"
"Do you think we are more beautiful?"
said the lady, interrupting his thoughts.
"No," said Ransom, and then correcting himself, "I don't know." It was indeed not easy to reply.
The young man, now that Weston's prosaic shirt and shorts were concealed, looked a more exotic and therefore a more imaginatively less squalidly hideous figure. As for the lady, that she looked in some way worse was not doubtful. Yet there is a plainness in nudity, as we speak of plain bread. A sort of richness, a flamboyancy, a concession as it were to lower conceptions of the beautiful had come with the purple robe. For the first and last time she appeared to him at that moment as a woman whom an earth-born man might conceivably love. And this was intolerable. The ghastly inappropriateness of the idea had, all in one moment, stolen something from the colours of the landscape and the scent of the flowers.
"Do you think we are more beautiful?" repeated the lady.
"What does it matter?" said Ransom dully.
"Everyone should wish to be as beautiful as they can," she answered, "and we cannot see ourselves."
"We can," said Weston's body.
"How can this be?" said the lady, turning to it. "Even if you could roll your eyes right round to look inside, they would see only blackness."
"Oh, not that way," it answered. "I will show you." It walked a few paces away to where Weston's pack lay in the yellow turf. With that curious distinctness which often falls upon us when we are anxious and preoccupied, Ransom noticed the exact make and pattern of the pack. It must have been from the same shop in London where he had bought his own, and that little fact, suddenly reminding him that Weston had once been a man, that he too had once had pleasures and pains and a human mind, almost brought the tears into his eyes. The horrible fingers which Weston would never use again worked at the buckles and brought out a small, bright object, an English pocket mirror that might have cost 3 and 6. He handed it to the green lady. She turned it over in her hands.
"What is it? What am I to do with it?" she said.
"Look in it," said the young man.
"How?"
"Look," he said. Then taking it from her, he held it up to her face. She stared for quite an appreciable time without apparently making anything of it. Then she started back with a cry and covered her face. Ransom started too. It was the first time he had seen her the mere passive recipient of any emotion. The world about him was big with change.
"Oh, oh," she cried, "what is it? I saw a face."
"Only your own face, beautiful one," said the young man.
"I know," said the lady, still averting her eyes from the mirror. "My face, out there, looking at me. Am I growing older, or is it something else? I feel... My heart is beating too hard. I am not warm. What is it?"
She glanced from one of them to the other. The mysteries had all vanished from her face. It was as easy to read as that of a man in a shelter when a bomb is coming.
"What is it?"
she repeated. "It is called fear," said Weston's mouth. Then the creature turned its face full on Ransom and grinned.
"Fear," she said. "This is fear,"
pondering the discovery. Then, with abrupt finality,
"I do not like it."
"It will go away," said the young man, when Ransom interrupted.
"It will never go away if you do what he wishes. It is into more and more fear that he is leading you."
"It is," said the young man, "into the great waves and through them and beyond. Now that you know fear, you see that it must be you who shall taste it on behalf of your race. You know the king will not. You do not wish him to. But there is no cause for fear in this little thing, rather for joy. What is fearful in it?"
"Things being two when they are one," replied the lady decisively. "That thing," she pointed at the mirror, "is me and not me."
"But if you do not look, you will never know how beautiful you are."
"It comes into my mind, stranger," she answered, "that a fruit does not eat itself, and a man cannot be together with himself."
"A fruit cannot do that because it is only a fruit," said the young man. "But we can do it. We call this thing a mirror. A man can love himself and be together with himself. That is what it means to be a man or a woman, to walk alongside oneself as if one were a second person, and to delight in one's own beauty. Mirrors were made to teach this art."
"Is it a good?" said the lady.
"No," said Ransom. "How can you find out without trying?" said the young man.
"If you try it and it is not good," said Ransom, "how do you know whether you will be able to stop doing it?" "I am walking alongside myself already," said the lady.
but I do not yet know what I look like. If I have become two, I had better know what the other is. As for you, Piebald, one look will show me this woman's face, and why should I look more than once?"
She took the mirror timidly but firmly from the unman and looked into it in silence for the better part of a minute. Then she let it sink and stood holding it at her side.
"It is very strange," she said at last.
"It is very beautiful," said the unman. "Do you not think so?"
"Yes."
"But you have not yet found what you set out to find."
"What was that? I have forgotten."
"Whether the robe of feathers made you more beautiful or less."
"Well, I saw only a face."
"Hold it further away and you will see the whole of the alongside woman, the other who is yourself. Oh no, I will hold it." The commonplace suggestions of the scene became grotesque at this stage. She looked at herself first with the robe, then without it, then with it again. Finally, she decided against it and threw it away. The unman picked it up. "Will you not keep it?" he said. "You might wish to carry it on some days, even if you do not wish for it on all days."
"Keep it?"
she asked, not clearly understanding. "I had forgotten," said the unman. "I had forgotten that you would not live on the fixed land, nor build a house, nor in any way become mistress of your own days. Keeping means putting a thing where you know you can always find it again, and where rain and beasts and other people cannot reach it. I would give you this mirror to keep. It would be the queen's mirror, a gift brought into the world from deep heaven. The other women would not have it. But you have reminded me there can be no gifts, no keeping, no foresight while you live as you do, from day to day, like the beasts."
But the lady did not appear to be listening to him. She stood like one almost dazed with the richness of a daydream. She did not look in the least like a woman who is thinking about a new dress. The expression of her face was noble. It was a great deal too noble. Greatness, tragedy, high sentiment, these were obviously what occupied her thoughts. Ransom perceived that the affair of the robes and the mirror had been only superficially concerned with what is commonly called female vanity. The image of her beautiful body had been offered to her only as a means to awake the far more perilous image of her great soul. The external and, as it were, dramatic conception of the self was the enemy's true aim. He was making her mind a theatre in which that phantom self should hold the stage. He had already written the play.